Tolian Chavichin's in full court press mode to get back into the pastoral office, and he says that King David would have been enemy number one on the Me Too movement's hit list. This is Matthew Garnett. Welcome to In Layman's Terms.
David would have definitely been public enemy number one of the Me Too movement.
Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in.
Yep, feeling like a little bit like Michael Corleone this week. Just when I thought I was out, they pulled me back in. This whole antinomian thing that we dealt with for about a year's time last year that I'm kind of trying to leave behind. Got Tolian Chavichin trying to get back in the pastoral office, and he gives a sermon on this that is just jarring, to say the least. And really, the main problem with it is he only gives one side of the story. See, this is called all gospel preaching. He presents the gospel beautifully. Unfortunately, it has no context because he doesn't properly present the law. Now, he does talk about the law, but he confuses law and gospel in the sermon. And that's really what we're going to get to. And then he compares King David to somebody who might be on the Me Too hit list, which was particularly appalling. But anyway, we'll talk about all that. But before we do, I want to remind you to listen to us on Pirate Christian Radio, and KNNA of the Cross. Wish they had a sound, because I love those guys up there. They're great. Pastor Clint Poppy and those guys were just so gracious to bring me on there. Very glad to be a part of their thing. And also, they've got a lot of great podcasts on their station as well, so be sure to check them out. Also, check out our art, our Kenyan Christian art. We've got some web sales in. Thank you all for buying our art. We appreciate it. We'll get that shipped right out to you as soon as possible. But go there to our website, laymanstermsradio.org. Click on the Kenyan Art tab and buy your art. That's the best way to do it. Also, don't forget, Kibos Hope Academy. We're drilling a well for them. Remember all this. Every week, we remind you people of this. $50. What I'm going to actually do is just try to get Monica to give us some testimonials of the children over there, what they're learning, that sort of thing. So maybe we'll you know, get some more intimate connections with that sort of thing. But please do continue to consider to give, but also do actually, pull the trigger on this. It's only $50, people. $50. Should be very doable for the vast majority of us. And we hope that this is a project you will choose to contribute to. That perhaps maybe you're giving monthly to something that's in that price range, and you could maybe hold off one payment to that charity for 1 month, give to this, and go that route. Again, I can't tell you how critical this is to get this well drilled, to help educate these children, bring them out of poverty, and get them well catechized. Again, remember, they are in fellowship with the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, so they're being taught the gospel, they're being taught sound doctrine there, and this is going to be these children are going to be the future of Kenya, and we want to help them along the way. So please give your $50 to Kibos Hope Academy Well Project. Okay, so we've got Tolian Chavichin giving the sermon, and again, there's a lot in there that's correct. There's some things in there that the jury is still out on. Like, for instance, can a defrocked pastor be restored to ministry? That's a big question that maybe the church hasn't in a long time taken seriously and debated very much or really talked about openly. And maybe it should. I don't know. The jury's still out with me on this. There's also, you know, in this day and time, especially with pop American Christianity, being a pastor, quote unquote, is not being a pastor. I mean, I was an evangelical pastor, and I didn't sign up to be a pastor. I didn't even know what that was going to entail. What I signed up for was preaching and speaking and being recognized. I signed up to be a leader. I did not sign up to be a pastor. And there's a huge difference between a pastor and a leader. Now, a pastor does need leadership skills. He does. He has to be able to lead his church, but that is not primarily his role. He is supposed to be a pastor. My, what my skill set is way better suited. I should have been a politician, if you want me to be honest with you, or a lawyer, or both. You know, those sorts of things. I can articulate myself fairly decently. I can write fairly decently. I'm good in school and these sorts of things. Actually, I'm kind of glad how things turned out because I love truck driving. But the thing of it is, I wanted to be somebody who was, you know, I was a speaker and a leader. I should have been a businessman or a lawyer or a politician or something like that. I should not have tried to be a pastor. I have my pastor has more pastoral skills in his little finger than I do in my entire intellect. I am just not cut out to be a pastor. But the thing of it was, I got fooled into this because I thought, you know, I'm going to be a leader and a speaker and a writer and a thought leader and all these sorts of things. And that's how evangelical the pastoral office is sold to evangelicals. And this is what they think. It goes on when you're a pastor is that you know, you're a speaker, you're a writer, these sorts of things. That's not what the pastoral office is about. And unfortunately, in pop evangelicalism, that's what it's been perverted into. And that's really the level on which Tolian Chavichan speaks in this sermon. He's not really interested, I don't think, in being a pastor. He wants to continue to be a thought leader and a speaker and these sorts of things. And so I would say if that's what he wants to try to do, so be it. He can go out there and try to be a thought leader and that sort of thing. But preaching from the pulpit on Sunday morning is the exclusive duty of the pastoral office. So at any rate, you'll kind of see how all this unfolds. It's not a very long sermon, but hopefully we can get into some detailed conversation about it. Just talk about how the fact that Tolian Chavichan should not be a pastor again. He certainly should not be. Should he speak and write? Well, if he's going to preach sound doctrine, that'd be great. That's my biggest problem with his Tolian.net site, is he's put up the same old sermons that he has before that fooled all of us at first, but now that we realize that those things are really do encourage a libertine lifestyle, they give permission to that sort of thing. I'd encourage you to go check out my friend Nathan Rennie's blog, Theology Like a Child, and check out a blog there by Cody Eds, and I don't know what the title of it is, but just search the blog for Cody Eds, E-D-D-S, and he's somebody who used to be one of Tolian's son's youth pastors at some church, and he came out of this, and he really very much explicitly lays out what the problems are, with that whole area of antinomianism and this sort of thing. We're going to kind of see that come out here, that it really does give license to a libertine lifestyle. It completely disregards the kind of lifestyle that Holy Scripture calls us to, and how very, very dangerous that is, not only to us, you know, kind of in a terrestrial, temporal way, but how dangerous that is to faith, and how dangerous it is really to the gospel. And that's really the bottom line with me with antinomianism, is when you don't preach God's commands, when you don't take God's law seriously as something to be obeyed, then ultimately what you end up losing is the gospel itself. So that's the danger here, and that's my biggest problem with Tolian coming out with Tolian.net, is that he hasn't repented an iota from the teaching he used to teach. He's still teaching the same old thing that I believe absolutely contributed to his falling into sin. So anyway, won't gild the lily any further. Let's get to this sermon on King David by Tolian Chavichan. Here we go.
My friend Jacob Smith, who's a pastor in New York City, once said that all of us are three bad days away from becoming a tabloid headline, and most of us are already on day two. Well, at a time when our worst private moments and our most shameful secrets and deepest character flaws can be easily found out and publicly exposed for the world to see, I find great comfort in the fact that King David knew exactly what that felt like. The Bible refers to David as a man after God's own heart, which is confounding to us when you look at his life. In so many ways, we tend to think of David's highlights. But in here in Psalm 51, David is giving expression to what's going on inside of him at the lowest point of his life. This man after God's own heart brought disgrace on his divinely appointed office. He sinned against God and all of God's people. He abused his God-given power for personal and sexual gain. He took advantage of a woman under his care and then had her husband killed to cover up the fact that he got her pregnant. If Jerusalem had tabloids, David's sordid story would have been plastered all over the front page. His well-known affair with Bathsheba and murder of her husband Uriah was played out in the public square. It was, without a doubt, a scandal for the ages.
Okay, so first of all, that is nowhere found in the text concerning, in 2 Samuel, concerning the affair between David and Bathsheba. In fact, God had to specifically tell the prophet Nathan that this was going on. Nobody else knew that it was going on. So I think that's an important point. You know, kind of proceeding from a false premise here already.
And to make it worse, it was permanently recorded in the Bible so that every generation from then until now would know about it. You can search certain people on Google and find out all sorts of dirt on their lives. Some of it may be true, some of it may be false, but Google searches are nothing compared to the documented truthfulness of the Bible. I mean, David's dirty laundry has been hanging in public for more than 2,500 years, and it's not going away. You can read about it today, you can read about it tomorrow, and you know that it's absolutely true because it's in the Bible, not an internet search necessarily. Apart from his defeat of Goliath.
Okay, so little bit of suspicion there with that comment. Likely construction stuff here. Eighth Commandment stuff. Can't prove it definitively. And I'm not going to go into a whole diatribe about the Eighth Commandment and these sorts of things. But I think it is important that when we are trying to discern sound doctrine and sound teaching from false doctrine and false teaching, that we have to do just that. We have to do some discerning, which means we have to read between the lines. I mean, I love what Pastor Wolfmuller says about this. You know, false teachers don't wear a t-shirt that says, "I'm a false teacher." Their wives don't walk around with t-shirts that say, "I'm with false teacher." I mean, it's a comical line, but they're not going to the false teachers are good at their jobs. They're wolves. Because they don't tip their hands. See? And so, that to me sounds like Chavichian trying to defend himself from what he deems to be internet slander. In other words, search for stuff on the internet, and there is a particular document, which I have in mind, which I don't have time to bring up right now, from one of the victims of his sexual exploits in detail. And I don't know if he's referring to that or not, and trying to discredit or not. But it's weird that he's bringing up the whole idea that you can Google search, and that may or may not be reliable, but we know that this is. So, and he's going to go on to talk about himself. This is just a weird sermon, first of all. And it's weird that he is defending the idea that he should be a pastor again? Is that what he's going for here? That he should be a pastor? He should have access to the pastoral office despite his sin? He's defending that on a Sunday morning from the pulpit in a church? That's a really weird place to do that from. In fact, I would say in a very inappropriate place from which to make that case. And yeah, that case should be made behind closed doors, discussed, you know, debated, these sorts of things. He should be focused on Christ and the gospel. And this is a very, in my opinion, very Tolian-centered sermon. That, yes, he does talk about how God is gracious through the sacrificial act of Christ and forgives our sins and these sorts of things. But this sermon is really about him, ultimately. See? And that's that's very distasteful at best, in my opinion.
Goliath, which is the story that most of us know about regarding David. But apart from his defeat of Goliath, David's sexual affair and murderous cover-up are what he is remembered for most. I mean, can you imagine if social media existed during David's time?
Okay, so real quick there. David's sin is not what he should be known for most. This is one thing I have a major problem with modern evangelicalism, or modern Christianity, period, in a lot of ways. In the Protestant realm, really in evangelicalism, just put it in the... We like to demonize the saints, the Old Testament saints in particular. We like to point out all their flaws and say, well, this is how gracious God is. God forgives all his flaws, which is true, but that's one part of the story. I mean, so think of the Tale of Two Cities type of idea. In all gospel, law gospel confused sermons, this is one thing to look out for, is that you only get one side of the story. So a red flag should go up to you. Maybe I should add this to my... So some of you might recall that I wrote a piece for St. John the Steadfast that talked about how to evaluate good law and gospel sermons. Well, this may be one thing that might throw off a red flag when all the preacher talks about is, especially an Old Testament saint's flaws. Because for the flaw, the sin that we see David having, this and the census, there's that as well. For the flaws we see David having, we see him repenting of these sins in a genuine way and receiving forgiveness. This is what Psalm 51 is all about, which is what Chavichin is preaching about. But beside that, David, King David, is a type and shadow of Christ. He is in the royal line of the Messiah. He led the nation of Israel in the way of God. They did not have pagan worship there. They had worship of the one true God there. And he was faithful in this. This is really what we're talking about. We're talking about faithfulness in the Old Testament. Did the king lead the people to worship the one true God, or did he lead them astray into other gods? Did he preach false doctrine? And this is an important point for Tullian to consider. It's an important point for me. Because, again, I wouldn't mind so much Tullian speaking if he would repent of his past false teachings, which, again, I contend led to his sin, led to a libertinism that gave him permission to do what he did in some way, shape, manner, or form. What you believe leads to how you practice, how you lead your life. So, the point being that antinomians in particular love to pull this trick and tell only one side of a multifaceted story about a character in the Bible, saying, look how much of a scumbag David was. That was really the central piece. That's the thing that everybody remembers about King David. Well, no, it's not. It's not really. That is not what is to be remembered about King David. In fact, the gospel would encourage us to cover King David's sins and only look at the good things he did. Only look at the way God sanctified him and brought him into the love of God's law, as we see in Psalm 119. These sorts of things. See, all the Old Testament saints, yes, were they flawed? Of course they were. Did God forgive their sins? Of course they did. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But if that's all the preacher is talking about, then this, generally speaking, indicates a problem with their law and gospel preaching.
David would have definitely been public enemy number one of the Me Too movement.
Okay, now that statement is just simply jarring. Very jarring. Because, again, this is what I was just talking about, taken to an extreme. Public enemy number one. In other words, he would have beaten Harvey Weinstein on this issue. He would have been viewed as worse than Weinstein, who for years
abused women and has been arrested for sexual assault. So that is a very, it's not a good comparison. In fact, I would call it a very stupid comparison. To compare King David to Harvey Weinstein. Weinstein is a very just not appropriate comparison. And of course, a guy like Chavichin might argue back, well, you see that as scandalous, but that's exactly what God wants us to see in this text, is how scandalous David was. No, it's not. For one thing, if you're going to talk about the Old Testament saint's sin and the subsequent forgiveness of that sin, which is a perfectly legitimate thing to talk about, that's gospel stuff and it should be preached. If you're going to talk about their sin, you should also talk about the law. Talk about the fact that David, in all the Old Testament saints who committed sins, are a cautionary tale to us, are a warning. This is not how Christians behave. This is not what we do, people. We don't steal our neighbor's wives and then have our neighbor killed so we can steal their wife. We don't do this. This is not Christian behavior. And if you engage in this, you will destroy yourself and everyone else around you. That is the kind of law preaching that should be coupled with the fact that David was forgiven of his sin. But that is going to be remarkably absent here, as Chavichin soft-pedals the law in this sermon instead of bringing it to us in full force and saying that not only are these examples of Old Testament saints who sinned examples of the gospel for us, they are also examples of law. That this is not how you're to behave. They are cautionary tales. In fact, Chavichin, if he wants to talk about himself in this sermon, should be standing up there saying, my life is a cautionary tale to tell you that if you go down this path, if you have these beliefs, if you don't believe, if you don't take very, very seriously the commands of Holy Scripture in your Christian life, you will destroy yourself and everyone around you. That's the kind of material he should be preaching if he's going to talk about himself here. Okay, that's, and we'll get to that. That statement's very jarring, and in fact, a stupid statement. He tweeted that out some time ago, and I think he got so laced on that by people just saying how dumb it was, me one of them, that he deleted the tweet. But here it is in audio form from this church. Very stupid thing to say. Poor comparison, and illustrates my point that antinomians will emphasize the fact that Old Testament saints committed sins and were forgiven, and that's all they'll talk about. They won't talk about their virtue, which King David certainly had. They won't talk about the fact that their lives are also a cautionary tale to us. So that's something to look out for.
Without question. I'm sure he was at that time tempted to disappear, to shut his mouth forever, to go into seclusion and never come out so that he could avoid the public's angry stares and wagging fingers. I mean, it is a lot easier and less painful to go into hiding when something terrible about you has been publicly revealed.
Okay, so he is getting ready to talk about himself, and he's already talking about himself here. He's inserting himself into the David story, and none of that is in the text about David and Bathsheba. David didn't go into hiding. He was the king. He could do whatever he wanted to do. This is why God warned Israel about having kings, because kings do whatever they want to do, including stealing other men's wives and having those men killed so they can have that wife for themselves. This is what kings do. And this is the seduction that King David got sucked into. In fact, I am convinced that one of the reasons why God warned Israel of having a king is because that kind of power is so seductive and pulls you in so easily to heinous sin that is very, very destructive. But David was not going into hiding, avoiding the wagging fingers of people. That would not have happened. They would not have publicized it in the tabloids. It's a ridiculous comparison. It's a ridiculous comparison without base, but it's an attempt by Chavichin to turn the King David story into his story. That's really what he's trying to do here.
And yet this notorious adulterer and murderer was lifted up by God to write his most famous hymn in the aftermath of his most infamous fall, and we can all be glad that he was.
Well, now I would disagree there, too, and say that Psalm 119 is the greatest psalm, Davidic psalm. That would be my contention. This is an opinion, because, again, Tolian is getting ready to talk about himself.
In fact, if David had not suffered through this dark night of the soul, we wouldn't have the shining light of his prayer for mercy. My mom, for years, has jokingly, but somewhat seriously, said that if Prozac existed in David's day, we wouldn't have half the Psalms that we have. There is something about God's light that shines in and through our darkness that we would not see if we never experienced dark nights of the soul. In fact, if David had not suffered through this dark night of the soul, we wouldn't have this particular psalm. We wouldn't have the shining light of his prayer for mercy in his darkest moment. Well, in Psalm 51, as I just read, David breaks down. He loses his composure as he composes his song of confession.
All right, and this is pretty much right. This is true. We would, save for David's heinous sin, we would not have Psalm 51, which we've all prayed. And we should all pray. And we all have dark nights of the soul. That doesn't mean we have to go out and utterly, we don't have to gather up our lives into a big heap, pour gasoline on it, and set it ablaze in order to relate to Psalm 51. We don't, because we all sin daily. And we should recognize that. And if we have to, the thing of it is, David could have written this psalm without the affair with Bathsheba. That may have been a way better point for Chavichin to make here. To say that, look, this wasn't even necessary. Does God use sin for good? Of course he does. He turns the evil of this world, transforms it into good. God works all things for good for those who love him. That is true. But God's not sitting up in heaven going, I wish you guys would sin some more so I could do some more good. This is reminiscent of Romans 6. Shall we go on sinning that grace may abound? May it never be. God doesn't need our sin. This is another mark of antinomianism. That we need to sin in order to show God's grace. No, we've pretty much got that covered. We don't need to go out and utterly destroy our lives and everyone else's lives around us in the process in order to show forth God's grace. We do enough sinning on a daily basis to recognize this. King David could have written this psalm without the affair with Bathsheba. See? The problem with this is that you don't see the, quote, little sins in your life that are destructive in, quote, little ways all around you all the time. So people think that we've got to go out and commit these gigantic sins. And again, gather up your whole life, put gasoline on it, put a match on it in order to show forth God's grace. God did not need King David to commit adultery with Bathsheba and murder Uriah in order for King David to sing the praises of God's grace. He used that for those purposes, sure. But could we still have Psalm 51 without David doing all these things? Yes, we could. Because David was an everyday, ordinary sinner just like the rest of us. He didn't. And incidentally, let me remind you, if you are familiar with Holy Scripture, that after this, God cursed David, essentially, saying that the sword would come to your kingdom. And it did. Think Absalom moving forward. Violence, war, chaos, and eventually, after Solomon, the kingdom splitting because of all this. The scriptures describing the seed of Jesse as a stump now, that it was cut off because of this sin here. So anyway, and we'll get into talking about more the temporal and eternal consequences of sin in relation to the gospel as we go here, because that's going to be relevant as well.
He absolutely comes clean. He says things like, "For I know my transgressions and my sin is ever before me. Against you and you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight." He calls sin, sin. He doesn't blame Bathsheba's beauty. He doesn't blame the devil. He owns his sin. He recognizes that he is the one responsible for the choices that he makes, and he comes clean. The kind of deceptiveness that he would have had to buy into in order to come up with a plot to not only have an affair with Bathsheba, but then to find out she's pregnant and to devise a plan to make sure her husband died on the front lines of battle so that he could take her as his wife and cover up the fact that he got her pregnant while she was married to Uriah. He calls sin for what it is. He owns it. He comes clean. He admits his sin. He admits his need for forgiveness. And he appeals to the only place, and more specifically to the only person, who can give him the mercy that he needs and that he longs for. He appeals to God's mercy. He begs for God's unfailing love and compassionate cleansing in the wake of his greatest failure. He knows that God and God alone can remove his guilt and set him straight and renew him and restore him. He knows that while others may never forgive him, he will be okay as long as he can be assured that God forgives him. Well, he pleads for these things: wash me, cleanse me, begs for mercy, owns his sin, appeals to the outrageous mercy of God. Having pleaded to God for these things, David then makes a promise. And this, for me, these verses specifically, verses 13 through 15 is where the psalm turns. And for me personally, these three verses, 13, 14, yeah, three verses gave me such hope that God was not done with me after my own crash and burn, after my own fall. For whatever reason, as often as I had read this psalm, as I said a few minutes ago, every Sunday morning before I preached, I would wake up and I would go into the loft that I had in my house, and I would look over my sermon, and as soon as I was done looking over my sermon, every Sunday morning I would read through this psalm. And as familiar as I was and have been with this particular psalm, it was verses 13, 14, and 15 that captivated me in a brand new, bright, and liberating way after I was experiencing my own dark night of the soul. Look at what he says. Having pleaded to God for all of these things, his mercy, confessing his sin, owning his sin, recognizing that he needed forgiveness, ultimately God's forgiveness, and pleading for God's mercy and appealing to God's love, look at what he says. Then I will teach transgressors your ways, and sinners will return to you. Deliver me from blood guiltiness, O God of my salvation, and then my tongue will sing aloud of your righteousness. O Lord, open my lips, and my mouth will declare your praise. He promises God that he will steward his failures in service to God and others. He promises God that he will tell the world about the seriousness of sin and the gloriousness of grace. He promises God that he will spend the rest of his days singing of God's righteousness.
Right. And so that's what I would like to hear Chavichin talk about, is talk about the seriousness of sin, which he never really gets around to. He talks about how, well, we shouldn't go out and try to fail. But that's not really talking about the seriousness of sin. If he really wanted to talk about himself in this sermon, that's something he should have focused on. But this is my best estimate. And again, I'm not entirely sure. Can't be entirely sure. But false teachers don't wear a t-shirt again. Have to discern these things. But this is a plea for him to be accepted kind of back into the evangelical mainstream as a credible teacher. This is what he's working on. And if he wants to do that, then he should talk more about the seriousness of sin. He certainly should talk about the gospel and God's grace. That's, you can't eliminate that. And he's talking about that in very beautiful ways here, in very beautiful ways, honestly. Because I know my own sin. Knowing that, I can listen to the gospel and know what Chavichin is saying is right in that regard. But also, where are the warnings? Remember our law gospel matrix. Where are the warnings against sin? Where is the part of the gospel that teaches us that because of God's grace and love for us, that we're transformed into new people and that we can be better people? Where's that part of the gospel? See, so you take my law gospel matrix, which we talked about ways back. Again, you can find that on Justin Center, not on Justin Center, but on St. John the Steadfast. You go to their website, type in law gospel matrix, you'll find my article on this. This is how I evaluate sermons. Law and gospel sermons. Many elements are missing here. And so, King David certainly talks about that. King David preaches God's ways, which means you walk in righteousness. You walk according to the commands of Holy Scripture. Part of the gospel is that it empowers us to stop being destructive people in this world, and that we no longer have to be like that. But yet, it seems Chavichin is bent on continuing to preach this all gospel message. And yeah, just throw in a dash of, well, you shouldn't really do that. You'll see what I'm talking about here. Type of law, but not really seriously talking about the destructive forces of sin and warning people against this and telling them that if you're caught in this kind of pattern, if you're caught in a sin, how destructive it can be. That's what's missing here.
And telling the world of God's praiseworthiness. In other words, this forgiven sinner now becomes the instructor of sin and forgiveness. This absolved adulterer now becomes the premier preacher of our unfaithfulness and God's fidelity or God's faithfulness. This pardoned life taker becomes the lead singer of a song about God who gives new life to those who deserve only death. David simply won't shut up. He can't shut up. God doesn't want him to shut up. My friend Chad Bird puts it this way: the absolution becomes a song in his heart that must be sung. He cannot keep his mouth shut about the seriousness of his sin and the gloriousness of God's grace. God broke him for this very reason. This man after God's own heart is now...
Okay, whoa, wait a minute. Now, God did not break him. King David... So, there's some inconsistency here. Chavichin just said that King David made these decisions. It was his sin. He owned it. God did not send this on him like some sort of unalterable plan of God's. King David's sin was not God's plan. It was King David's sin. That's a major error there.
Singing about the heart of God from a place of deep experience that he could not have known apart from failure. For the last number of...
Again, I would point out that yes, you cannot know the grace of God apart from sin and failure. Granted, but you don't have to gather up your life, pour gasoline on it, and light a match to it in order for God's grace to be understood. People do this all the time. God did not need King David's sin in order to show forth the gospel in a more powerful way. That's an exegetical mistake. I want to reiterate that.
Weeks, my wife and I have been traveling to different places, a few days here, a few days there, and I've had the opportunity to speak and preach and do some interviews and things like that. And as I've done those things, there has been a line that I have been going to almost subconsciously in every message that I've given or every interview I've done. It's simply this, that when it comes to the things that matter most in this world and in our lives, I have discovered that success is far more dangerous than failure. Far more dangerous. We avoid failure. We shouldn't seek to fail. But we do. All have sinned and fallen short of God's glory.
Okay, so there's his weak attempt at preaching the law. We shouldn't seek failure. Well, and he substitutes this word failure for sin. And again, he is completely shaving off the sharp edges of the law here. Shouldn't seek to fail. Shouldn't seek to sin. But we're going to anyway. Let's see. I mean, that's kind of the good news of the antinomians. Is that shouldn't seek to sin. But you're going to anyway. You're going to fail. So, God be praised, we have the cross. Well, that's great news. I can fail and have no worries. That's the good news of the antinomians. Not that their sin is forgiven and God's wrath has stayed. That his hand is kept from throwing us into the pit of hell. But that our sin's maybe just not that serious. That's how this comes across, I would say.
We do fail. And what I've discovered is that when I was most successful, I was most blind. That in so many ways, being at the top is so much more dangerous than being at the bottom.
I agree with that 100%. Being a celebrity pastor is a very, very dangerous thing. Celebrity is a very dangerous place to be in. It is.
You become proud. You begin to believe your own press. You begin to become a little bit more self-righteous, perhaps, and think that you have it all together, that maybe you're better than the person sitting.
And unfortunately, he conflates this with moral living. Being a celebrity pastor is, you know, being successful, quote unquote. So he's talking about success and failure, kind of in a secular sense, of being famous and not famous, or achieving your dreams and not achieving your dreams. He's not talking about this in moral terms. He's conflating the two things, actually, because by Chavichian standards, I don't know if my pastor would be, quote, successful. He's a very good man. The Lord has used the gospel to transform this man's life, and he's a man with integrity and forthrightness and all of the qualities you would want in somebody who is shepherding you in the gospel and in the ways of our Lord. He knows his sin. He admits his sin freely. These sorts of things. But he does. He has yet to gather up his life in a pile and pour gasoline and set a match to it. That's kind of the idea. Would he be successful, quote unquote, in the eyes of Chavichian? He's moral. The Lord has used the scripture and his position as pastor to make him a good man, an example for us to follow in both law and gospel. But is he in danger of this kind of situation Chavichian's talking about? I don't think so. He's not a celebrity. That's really the danger that Chavichian's talking about. That's really maybe what he should point out to his pop evangelical friends. And maybe it should be something he should point out to himself. Stop seeking celebrity as a minister of the gospel. If that's really what you want, if Chavichian wants to get back into the ministry, seeking celebrity is the last thing he should be doing. Because coupled with his false theology, his celebrity is what led to his downfall, in my opinion.
Next to you, or you're better than the person that you see on television or on the news or whatever the case may be. My friend David Zoll says it this way: we all believe that we have fallen short of God's glory, but that doesn't prevent us from comparing distances. We do that pretty regularly. But failure has a way of sobering us up to our fallibility, to our ultimate dependence on God. Failure has a way of reminding us that we're not as good as we like to think we are, that we're far worse than we think we are, But that, in turn, reveals that God's grace is infinitely greater than anything we could ever ask for or imagine. You see, David's song, and this is something that's been occupying my heart and mind for nearly 2 years now, that David's song and story are proof that God's intention for those who crash and burn is not for them to stay quiet. It's not. Now, depending on one's circumstances, a crash and burn, bottoming out, may require a time of quiet, may require a time of silence and going before God and having God deconstruct you in a variety of different ways so that he can begin the reconstruction process. But God's ultimate goal for the person who crashes and burns and comes to fresh terms with their own powerlessness is not that they will stay quiet forever so that they will shut their mouths. Rather, God intends to pick them up, wash them off, and open their mouths wide so that they will speak more loudly than ever of his amazing grace and unconditional love. Psalm 51 is biblical proof that however one wants to interpret the qualification passages in Timothy and Titus, they are not meant to silence the voices of all who have failed, of all who have bottomed out. There are those passages in Timothy and Titus where the Apostle Paul is giving instructions about who's qualified to be a leader in the church. And oftentimes people read those and they conclude that that list is a lifetime list, so that if anybody at any point in time has ever been guilty of any of these things, they are forever disqualified. Well, those who interpret those passages that way actually scare me to death. Because what they're ultimately saying is that they are qualified. And if there is one thing more scary than someone leading a church who is not qualified, it's someone leading a church who thinks they are.
Okay, so we're going to brush away those passages in Timothy and Titus for qualifications of a pastor. There are pastors who are judged to be qualified. Now, does the pastor individually sit there and think, well, I'm qualified to have this office? Well, I'm not sure that kind of hubris is going on, and it really doesn't matter. Who decides ultimately who's qualified and who isn't is the church. But there are qualifications. And these aren't... This whole idea of being staying silent is... So here's what's going on here. And here's the major problem I had with this whole sermon. Is that Chavichian is equating being able to speak about one's fall and return to grace and telling people, you know, hey, let me warn you about sin. Let me warn you how destructive this is. And let me warn you how your theology can lead you down that way. And my theology did do that. He's not doing any of that. And then let me remind you that if that happens to you, that there is still grace for you, that God forgives sin. And that there's strength and power in that. He's equating that with the pastoral office. The reason the qualifications for the pastoral office are there is because a man called to the pastoral office is called to care for the sheep and look after them, not kill them. Imagine if you hired a shepherd. He said, I want you to look after these sheep. And no problem. Does a great job looking after the sheep. But then one day, he decides to take out his sword and chop the heads off of a few of the sheep. And you come by and you go, what the heck? Why did you kill the sheep when I told you to look after them? Well, you know, I really like killing sheep. You just have this really drive and desire to kill sheep. Okay, you're fired. You're no longer the shepherd. And then, you know, say for instance, this story goes viral and is widespread about this former shepherd who killed sheep. The next guy along the line, is he going to be apt to hire this person? Even though he was really good before, he killed some sheep. The thing of it is, the reason those qualifications are there is it's a trust issue. Being a pastor for Chavichin is about being a celebrity, a speaker, and a writer. It's not about being a shepherd of a flock of God's people. He wants back in the public square. And that's what he's vying for here. He wants to be a pastor again so he has that platform in a church and so he can make money off of it. Maybe that's too harsh. I retract the make money off of it statement. Don't know that for sure. He doesn't want to have to seek another career, another way to make money. I mean, he's too poor to dig, or he's too old to dig, or something from that parable. I'm not sure exactly what's going on here. But that's what he's equating the pastoral office to, and that is not the pastoral office. The pastoral office is one of trust. And when you break trust the way Chavichin broke trust on a wide, I mean, the more public you are, this is the big danger of being a celebrity pastor. When you break that trust, then it's really, really hard to regain that in the way that you had it before. Very, very difficult. I would say almost impossible, because people simply don't trust you. And that is a natural consequence of your sin. That is not people usurping God's grace. That is not people holding your sin. That is people. Friends, the gospel is not a suicide pact. We've talked about this before. It is not you saying that, hey, here's the shepherd who killed some sheep, but let's just go ahead and immediately trust him with some more sheep. And, you know, because God forgives and we should forgive too. That's not how the gospel works. One of the natural consequences of committing manifest sin the way Chavichin did, in the public way that he did, in the public position he was in the celebrity position he was in, one of the consequences of that is people are not going to trust you. They're not even going to want you to speak. They're not even going to want to hear you after that. They don't trust you. And for good reason. You killed some of the sheep. You took advantage of them. And nobody's sure we can trust you. That's what the qualifications of Timothy and Titus are about trust. Can we trust this man to shepherd God's people? It's not about staying silent or anything of that nature. I think Chavichin should talk to people about what he went through on a personal level, not a public level. He's inserting himself into the story of King David, equating himself with King David, which is hubris, in my opinion. Not King David. King David is a type and shadow of Christ. And he's inserting himself into the King David story to try to argue from this pulpit that he should be accepted back into the public sphere of pop American evangelical Christianity again. That's the argument that essentially he's making and will make. He hasn't really got around to himself yet. And I don't know if we're going to continue with this, because that's really the point I wanted to bring out here, that he gets to. Those qualifications are there to give the flock peace of mind that this man isn't going to turn on them or murder them spiritually or take advantage of them sexually. Because less than 2 years ago, that's what Chavichin did. Can he be trusted yet? My answer is no. He can't be trusted yet. There's still too much damage that's got to be repaired. Some more time has to go by, in my opinion. He hasn't gone through any sort of restoration process with his former denomination. He just fled that, if there was any kind of discipline at all. And he's trying to re-enter the public life via the pulpit of this church. And they're giving him a platform, you know. So, at any rate, the comparisons aren't equal here. There's not two sides of the story here. Can a pastor be restored to the office? Can a defrocked pastor be restored to the office? For me, the jury's still out on that. I don't know if he can, honestly. Once you break trust on, especially on a level like this, very difficult to restore trust. Very difficult, even after many years past, and it's been less than 2 years. It's been less than 2 years. And so that I'm not sure about. Many denominations are very clear on this, including his former denomination, the Presbyterian Church of America, the PCA. They're clear. You break trust like this, you're done. We will not trust you again. It's not a forgiveness issue. Of course people forgive him. I hope people forgive him. They should. Christ died for his sin. He should be forgiven, to be sure. But can he be trusted? We don't know. We're not sure yet. I mean, for one thing, again, he continues to preach the same doctrine that, again, in my opinion, led to his sin. So at any rate, this is really what this sermon's about. I think, go listen to the whole thing. We only got, a bit of the way through it. And judge for yourself. I mean, he begins to talk about himself right about here. He's really making an impassioned plea to be reinstated to the pastoral office. And this Lutheran Brethren Church is giving him that opportunity, in a sense. And I would not be surprised to see him get ordained with them, reemerge as a pastor, these sorts of things. But I think that would be a major mistake. Major mistake. Because pastors are called in the power of the gospel to a higher standard. And that higher standard is there because if that higher standard is broken, then trust is broken with your flock. It's not about speaking and teaching and whatever else. You can kind of do all that as much as you want. You know, people can choose to listen to you, not to listen to you. But when you're a pastor of a church, the stakes are much higher and completely different. So he's conflating these ideas. If he wants to be a speaker and a writer, go try to be a speaker and a writer. And if people want to listen to you, great. If they don't, fine too. But going back into the pastoral office, I think, especially with this denomination, I think it would be a major mistake on their part. Anyway, we've got to go. I don't think I'm going to continue this next week. There's a lot more I could comment on here, but hopefully we've made the point. Listen to us on KNNA The Cross, Pirate Christian Radio. Check out the Kenyan Christian art on our website. And also, don't forget to give your $50 for the Well Project. We'll see you next week.
Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. It brings salvation to those who believe. Hey, preacher man, give me the gospel. Tell me I'm a sinner and Christ died for me. I don't want to know about what you did last week on your summer vacation, what you saw, where you went, or how much it cost. Instead, won't you tell me